So far, Brueggemann is, how would you use the book? Who would you share it with? What do you do with this thing so far?
Maybe Sunday school classes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Help people take the Bible more seriously, okay. Maybe not so scary.
Okay.
I'd share it with my mother.
What?
I'd share it with my mother.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
An adult inquiry class for new people interested in the church.
It fits there beautifully,
yes.
Doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It really feels like it's a foundational book,
yes.
Of very basic stuff. Yeah.
Also, as an introduction to that, probably violates the spirit of the thing, but an introduction to a Bethel study.
Yes.
Study of the Bethel Bible series.
Yeah, that would work there. I'm becoming more and more uncomfortable with the title. I'm not sure what I'm concluding about that, but I think he could have done better on it.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
Because in some ways, can I just be Jim Fish for a minute?
Please.
The reason why I'm uncomfortable with this title is because the Bible makes sense. It's a very rational Greek kind of way of approaching them. Makes
yes.
it sound like
yes.
we're gonna explain why it is that they're two creation stories. And what he's saying is, we don't want it to make sense in your head. We want you to be a participant
in
the Bible.
In holy history.
Yeah. Isn't that fun?
That is. That's very good.
You also probably know, but maybe do not know, the cover, the design of the cover, and the title in any contract is the publisher's domain. The author can suggest. The author can suggest. And if the publisher likes it, it means you don't have to pay somebody at the publishing house to come up with the title. But usually the publisher.
So you didn't have any say.
They took our title. But Rosemary Ruther in the Community of Christ was going to have a lawsuit. The radical kingdom was going to be the violent kingdom. And they finally, instead of having a lawsuit, said, okay.
So you can't pick
they were going to publish it as the violent kingdom, and she...
Why did they do that? I mean, you write
it. I don't know.
They
want to sell the book. Yeah. If you read Musical Mystical Bear, Matthew Fox says, the first fights I had was the cover, because he wanted this little bear that was flying, and the title. They said, you can't go to the Christian Booksellers Convention and sell Musical Mystical Bear. That's not what people are buying. So Brueggemann may not agree.
It's interesting. Next, after Merton, we're going to look at the cover of Life Together, which was selected. The cover photograph for the little paperback of Life Together was selected by someone who didn't read the book.
Oh, gee.
I mean, the cover is just completely contrary to the contents of the book.
Young adults around a campfire by a lake.
Yeah, singing Kumbaya.
Yeah.
Life Together. That is precisely what it's not about.
No,
it's another
paperback.
Yeah.
I've got a different edition of the paperback.
So me too, it's
got colors.
Lines
and
colors. Oh, it'd be fun to ask Walt Brueggemann sometime if he feels okay about this. All right, another handout today, two pages again. Stapled together, bonus time. Underline major points.
Here, are we getting
nothing. Who needs to read the book? It's all right here.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is this is the only one that we're doing like this, where those of you who are reading it because you want to, and but I know most of you are not reading it, and so this is a way in which we can get a great share of the book without having to.
You want to go out in the world as an introduction to the Bethel Bible series.
Right, mm-hmm. Could go out in the world like that, print it in the Holden Press.
There you go.
Now, one thing we have here at the conclusion of this hour is half of the book. Okay, that's all we've got. So I hope that whets your appetite so that you can go on to look at the other chapters, which are about conversion.
Yes.
You want to talk about what is conversion? What does getting converted mean? Brueggemann's says that that's a major theme in the Bible, and what conversion is biblically. Death to life, power to become children of God. We've been working in Yoder about power and what power is, servant power as opposed to other power, power to become children of God. And then the last two chapters are a summary of perspectives in the Bible and the Bible and its community. Okay. The God of the Bible, I'm just going to read along and just visit a little bit. Introduction. This is fun. The center of the odd perspective of the Bible, God. That's his chapter title. I mean, how does that strike you right off the bat?
Cumbersome.
Yeah. Okay, not well written. What else?
Odd perspective.
Huh?
I just don't understand odd perspective. Center of the odd perspective.
What? Say more.
The title's confusing to me. I don't know.
Doesn't make any sense. What else? The center of the perspective of the Bible. God. That makes sense. I mean, I figure that the Bible is about his God, right? But he says that that's an odd perspective for the Bible to have.
I don't get it.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So what perspective should the Bible have? I don't understand the title very well. Or at least it makes me wonder. Let's see if we can pin him down on it and see what he's doing with this thing. The God of the Bible... Oh, now he's starting to make sense already. The God of the Bible is unlike the gods of other religions. It's embarrassing. The God of the Bible is embarrassing. So the center of the biblical perspective is a God who's not normal. That's what we could think up a better title for the chapter. Right?
The center of the perspective of the Bible, an odd God.
That's
right. Odd is on God, not on perspective.
Yes, an odd God. Let's just do that.
God is weird. That wouldn't be a very good time for a chapter either. God is still...
We did, some of us had visited about the parables, and we said that 99 sheep stay in the wilderness, and the odd God goes looking for the one lost one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which does not make sense.
Right.
No self-respecting shepherd would do such a thing. The odd father welcomes home the prodigal son by running out to the son and saying, let's have no Jewish father would do that. Odd God, okay. God is, and the reason why this is an odd God, compared to the gods of Buddha and the gods of the other Eastern religions and the gods of this and that and other cultures, the reason Rubenman says that the God of the Bible is an odd God is that this God is with his people, the other gods are not, and this God is for his people, the other gods are not. With that, with his people and for his people. God is not known in the Bible for toughness or for remoteness or for transcendental spookiness, but in his readiness to be with and for his people. That's the odd God. What Brueggemann is also saying under the is that we are just like people all around the world. We're more comfortable with a spooky, transcendental, angry, distant God. And when we read about the God that is close to home, the God who is with us and for us, we don't know how to handle this. No matter whether we're in this culture or China or whatever culture, our favorite gods are always the gods far off and angry. But that is exactly what the Bible does not give us. God is with us not through bribery, not through through intimidation, but simply because God is for others by nature. That's the heartbeat of God is for others. God covenants with her people. He keeps saying him all the time, so I just change it to her occasionally, just to be fun. Now, there are four dimensions of the covenant making that MSKRT is a maker, okay? Four dimensions of God as covenant maker in the Old Testament.
How is that maker?
It's an abbreviation for maker.
I see.
It just has the name of God. It has no vowels.
I guess I wouldn't have.
Hebrew, yes.
I want to go back to the line above. God is not with us through bribery. In other words, the God of the Bible isn't the God who is with us if we pay our dues. God doesn't bribe us. Brueggemann says many of the gods in the world do. Nor is God with us through intimidation. Well, you know, I'm with you. Sure, I'm with you. You better watch out. That sort of intimidation. That's not the way in which God is with us. Bonhoeffer, this picks up, but simply because he is for others. Bonhoeffer says the most important thing to say about Jesus is Jesus is for others. That's the bottom line on Jesus. That's the most important thing to say. Who is Jesus? He is the one for others. Four dimensions of God is the covenant maker in the Old Testament. Okay, these. Let's wait on that. Now you are God's people. Boy, I need a Bible.
Here
you go. Thank you. Now you are God's people. Exodus chapter 3, 7 through 8. I quote it here. I have seen the affliction of my people. Where are my people afflicted? Where are they?
Egypt.
Yeah. They're in Egypt. I have seen the affliction of my people, and I have heard their cry, and I know their sufferings. I have come down to help them. Note, Brueggemann says the stages. There are four here. First, God takes note of the trouble they're in Egypt. Then, God takes that trouble seriously. That's the second stage. Third stage is God actually does something about it. Excuse me. The third stage is that God actually does something about it. That's the last decisive step. That God inserts herself into the crisis on behalf of the captive ones. Brueggemann says this is unique in religion. Lots of gods notice, lots of gods feel compassion, but the God of the Hebrews does something, gets into the brickyard in Egypt. That's the difference in the biblical God. Gets down to it. Now you are God's people. How are you God's people? Not because of any prayers said from Egypt. Not because the people in captivity were necessarily moral, but because God chose them. Yeah, it's God's decision. Okay. She comes to the help not of the honorable, but of the rabble. Exodus. God actually creates a people that did not exist. Once you were nobody, now you are God's people. That's from 1 Peter. Okay? God creates a people that does not exist. It is no wonder then that at the end of the book of Exodus, the people get all excited. Exodus 15:11. I mean, they're just happy as a lark. Listen to this. Who is like thee, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like thee, majestic in holiness, terrible in glorious deeds, doing wonders? There's no God like you. That's their claim. Another tie to the parables that we've talked about. Notice under C that God creates a people that did not exist. Remember the parable of the seed becoming the big bush?
Mm-hmm.
From nothing, or from the littlest nothing, comes the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
From the leaven, from a little piece of leaven, comes the big loaf.
Mm-hmm.
It's an Old Testament theme as well. From the brickyard comes the kingdom, comes the people of Israel. Okay. That's a New Testament way of saying this Old Testament thing. The Old Testament is chock full of grace. The idea that the Old Testament is law and harshness and thou shalt and God down on us is simply a misreading of the Old Testament. Do you feel the grace in the whole thing as they perceive it? We were nobody, we were made somebody. Anybody want to respond to that? Okay, That's the first big dimension that Brueggemann says is in the Old Testament, as God, when we think about God as covenant maker. The other one is God is present with power. God has more than good intentions, warm fuzzies for his people. God acts, does stuff. For example, here's a Yoder thing. The Lord will fight for you, and you only have to be still. Exodus 14:14. The whole chapter was called Our God Will Fight For Us.
So he doesn't just talk about it, he does it.
Right. And it's an Old Testament theme that Yoder is picking up out of Luke. And that Luke picks up out of the Old Testament and comes forward. He routed the Egyptians. And there's lots and lots of other examples of the Lord fighting for us. God does not fight for those who might win anyway, but for those who cannot defend themselves. That's consistent in the Old Testament. Now B. Joseph in Egypt is another example of the same thing. Genesis 39 is where that whole thing is talked about, if you want to look that up. The Lord was with Joseph. See, there is primitive war assurance in A, up here, in the Lord will fight for us, but also the deep assurance of B. In other words,
God present with power in the Old Testament is in two dimensions, felt two ways. One way that God, they talk about God being with us in power is war language. Our God will fight. That, meaning that, that battle, a mighty fortress is our God. Lots and lots of military imagery. That's one of the ways. The other way is not a military image at all, but as in B with Joseph in Egypt, it is a sense of the powerful presence of God. Not talked about in military terms, but more talked about in emotional terms, even warm, fuzzy terms. Joseph says, oh, God's with me. I feel God inside me. Okay? Not militarily speaking, but in a different way. Okay. Power. Third, abiding presence. That Israel understood that God was for them because God actively created a space, real estate. One of Brueggemann's book is The Land. All right? That God creates real estate where the people will know God is around. Psalm 84, how lovely is thy dwelling place. The 23rd Psalm is about what? Valley of the Shadow, right? Mm-hmm.
Green pastures.
I shall lay down in green pastures. There's a lot of talk about abiding presence on a piece of ground. The people's worth, the people's dignity and confidence are all protected when they are in the presence of God. But now you ask the question, and this is American civil religion right now. Will the people of Israel then domesticate God? You know, God, our little pet, who we invite lie down in green pastures. God's our buddy, and everything's going to be great now. No. Will they domesticate God, make God their little national pet? Nope. 1 Kings 8:27 says God is above our domestication, and it says it in its own way. We'll look it up. God not only abides with us, but also works for us when we can't or when we don't know what we need. Important thing here, okay? God works. Picture South Africa, okay? South Africa can't work for what they need. The God's people in South Africa, some of them, are captive. And they simply are totally without power. The message of the Old Testament to them is, yes, you are without power. God is working for you. You can't do zip, but God can and is. Don't forget that. There's another side of the coin. The other side of the coin is, and this applies more to America, when we don't know what we need. God says, well, you may not know what you need, but I know what you need, and this is it, folks. Hang on. Okay? Judgment. But the judgment is always mercy. Feel it, the double dimension to the thing there? Is that clear at all? Huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah?
I'm going to throw
a,
just play the devil's advocate.
Good,
here.
Throw a zinger in, yeah, good.
If God is such a merciful God, and people say in South Africa, or there have been oppressed people for a long time,
yeah.
Just use that South African situation. Is God really working? I mean, those people are still suffering, and if God is omnipotent and powerful, why doesn't something happen? I mean, it's been like that, what, for 400 years?
Yeah.
Ever since the Dutch came here?
Yeah. Could anybody respond to that?
Go ahead, Jim.
Such a great God.
How long were the Israelites in Egypt?
400 years.
Well, I don't know if that answers my question.
No, it doesn't. I was just waiting.
Does somebody want to respond? If that's such a big deal, why the delay? Go ahead.
Well, I don't know. I remember in the Bethel Bible series going through the Old Testament, and the big thing was we can't see what he's doing now. Mm-hmm. But when we study, we can see the blessed blessing.
It seems like there's so much suffering. And I sometimes have a hard time seeing what the big deal is. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
Holly that we can't see what he's doing. What he's doing, we can't see him.
I mean, we don't always understand the way he works. I mean, it isn't for us to just listen.
Things don't change very fast.
Is that partly because God is God and she can do anything she wants to, but she insists on being in relationship to us, and we're the ones that are left holding the bag, that we don't, we're not being partners with God.
That would make more sense to me.
That's kind of how I always feel about it. And the reason why there are people suffering in South Africa, at least partly, is because I don't take their suffering nearly as seriously as God does.
I kind of, the only thing that I would be able to respond to that kind of thing is the other side of God acting in the Old Testament, like being with Joseph. You know, Joseph knew that God was there, and that even in the time when, you know, at the point when he was just basically throwing away his good position with Potiphar, he knew that God was still there. And, you know, he ended up in jail. And I think the people over in Africa can feel this awareness of God is with them. You know, they may be hungry, they may have difficulties, but I think that their awareness of God is much more intense. Reminds me of who you related that last night about that tape.
I think it was Jim.
The guy had this tape of all
these tapes of worship service in South Africa.
Yeah, you know, you get the impression that they really feel a much more personal awareness of God.
So, in other words, that's where men meet God.
Uh-huh. We, from our perception, nothing's going on in South Africa. From their perception, as we heard, as I relayed this incident about the tape that we heard, they think a lot's going on. They think they're not happy with everything that's going on, but they have no question of what the Lord of History is working in their land through them.
Is it improving their 400-year-old problem?
Excuse me?
Is it improving their 400-year-old problem? Well, what they think it is, that they're making strides through God?
Well, the whole world community is watching them and watching the whole situation. So then I don't know if they think it's improving, but at least it certainly has everyone's attention. I don't know if they have any sense of improvement or not. Probably not.
They have a sense of expectation based on promise.
Yeah.
That even if they don't see right now vast improvement. And I think they do see some improvement. I think they are suffering in hope. That's Manus Buthelezi's phrase. We suffer in hope. But that's sometimes based only on promise, without any visible evidence of God other than his word of promise.
Yeah.
And
I just finished reading Night to Night.
Did you?
See all of
that
too. What's it called?
Night. Haley Weisel. Mm-hmm. Haley Weisel. Survived the Holocaust. He was going to be the next speaker at California Lutheran College. There's some of those passages in Night are as powerful as any literature.
But the men do know how they could keep their faith up through all that.
Yes.
Unreal.
So,
most of the Jews didn't keep their faith up.
Well, there were those who didn't, but you know, those, even in the book too, there were those who appeared to just, you know, give up on it completely, and yet when it got right down to the end, the thing they would do is start saying the Kaddish or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
They went, you know, it was there.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I was suggesting was that it's exception. I've been told by several sources that Israel on the whole is an atheist state, that they don't believe in God because of the trouble they've gone through, because of his absence.
I've heard that too.
I've talked to Israelis who said that.
Yeah.
Well, the Holocaust certainly put a big hole in Jewish theology.
Yeah.
I mean, that was, I never realized that, but I talked to some Jewish people once and they just said, you know, this really screwed up the way we look at God.
Question of blessing.
Yeah.
Of what?
Of blessing.
Oh, what
they think the, what the, why were they chosen? Did that help at all?
I was asking because I get those kind of questions.
Sure.
Yeah.
You do know, like, the material in Job and other literature, JB and other things, on why people suffer. I mean, it's a problem that has been written about, prayed over, agonized over, dramatized.
Lewis has got a heavy book on pain.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Problems.
Yeah. Probably pain.
The fourth dimension of God is covenant maker. Notice all these are ways in which love is going on. Okay? God's the great lover. And these are four dimensions of the love of God. Okay, the last is fear not. Two of the most favorite words in the Old Testament. When everything looks terrible, there comes a salvation oracle, as it's called, that always begins with fear not. In the oracle, God redefines the situation. When this happens, people don't become afraid, only amazed. South Africa. Fear not. You are in a miserable condition, but then the Salvation Oracle, if it were happening today, would go on to redefine what's really taking place. So, as the Salvation Oracles written down all through the Old Testament are the prophets and others looking at the situation and saying, here's what God says. Fear not, I'm redefining what's really going on. You can make it now, because it's been redefined. Fear not, Abraham, I am your shield, your reward will be great. Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the land where he is. These fear not words are often heard during the exile, in other words, during tough times. They are, again, the love of God shows itself four ways. You were nobody, now you're somebody. I made you, that I am with you in power, that I am a presence with you, helping you when you need it, and when you don't even know what you need, I help. And fear not. Your fear can be turned to amazement because I am taking care of the situation. That's the four ways in which Old Testament God as lover is seen. Now, four ways, Brueggemann says, that the same thing is seen in the New Testament. That God, with his people, comes to an expression, full expression, in Jesus. When the church says the Word became flesh in John, that is not metaphysical doctrine. In other words, that's not speculative philosophy. Okay? That's not trying to write out a definition of how does Jesus relate to God when we see him. You know, some very elaborate thing that only a German scholar with polished shoes could write. That's not what it's saying. Okay? It's saying a much more earthy thing than that. It is saying God is with his people, just like it said in the Old Testament. But Jesus is a new way of saying the same old thing. When the church says the Word became flesh, that's not metaphysical doctrine, but it is the church's confession that in the radical self-commitment of Jesus, the powerless and the worthless of his time, we can discern the full commitment of God to his world in life-giving ways. We are bold to affirm that in Jesus we know fully and unmistakably that God is not only with us, but for us.
What's going on down here in the New Testament, Brueggemann says, absolutely nothing new. It's the same old thing that was up in the Old Testament. And he says the richness of the new has to be understood with some perspective out of the old. The studying the Old Testament is very, very important. Another way of looking at God as lover in the New Testament is the names. Emmanuel, God with us. The birth announcement in Luke comes in the form of an Old Testament war assurance, as in number two above, God present with power. The name of Jesus, he says, just consider that. The name Jesus calls to mind from the book of Judges the great heroes of Israel who fought for them. The name Emmanuel is from Isaiah 7, which says that the Lord will intervene and turn about a situation of political oppression. Emmanuel is a political name.
Even heavenly host is a heavenly battalion.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of word, lots of battle imagery. Do you see the parallels to above what's going on there? Third, Jesus' ministry. Concern in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, not with who he is, very important, not with who he is, but what he does. It's the actions of Jesus that forever get talked about. The Old Testament tradition is that we know God by what he does. The same thing is true in the New Testament. And that is that power is to the weak, food to the hungry, healing to the sick, life to the dead.
If you've been reading Yoder.
Mm-hmm. Do they? Mm-hmm. I mean, the connections are just all through here. Lots and lots of connections.
Yoder made a big point of, thou art my beloved son, as not a metaphysical coexistence of the son. It's not so that we can have a doctrine of the Trinity.
Right.
It's a position and what he was to do. God's right-hand man is a task. Not some doctrine about the essence of Jesus being the second person of the Trinity. That's okay for us to go back and make that doctrine, because it's a way of our theology for understanding Jesus. But thou art my son did not mean that, first of all. That's another point. Similar to... He uses Jesus and Emmanuel, but he doesn't use Christ.
The most obvious one.
Right. And Yoder took a more obvious one. It's funny that Brueggemann doesn't.
Jesus,
the Christ.
Yeah.
It's a political term.
There are three promises that tell us who God is in Matthew. The Gospel of Matthew opens with Emmanuel, God with us, and closes, Gospel of Matthew ends with, and I am with you always to the close of the age, sort of an envelope, beginning and end. Mm-hmm. Because God is with us, something is asked of us, namely, go therefore and make disciples. We're not asked to make disciples in order to make God come to us, but because God is here, we can do that. It's grace in Matthew, it's grace in the Old Testament as well. That's one promise that tells us who God is.
These typos are great. Behold the swelling of God.
Where is it? Oh, yeah. Yes. Lost it. Keeps it more interesting.
Read what you write.
Keeps it more interesting.
If you ever publish, you get an editor. Because any of those things written freely in a book, people will just be upset.
They'll laugh, won't they?
That's the announcement to Mary, right?
Right. Yes. That's the birth announcement. The two words we're focusing on here is for us, with us, for us. I mean, that's just a chant that goes over and over. With us, for us. Emmanuel is with us. Matthew starts his gospel by saying God is for us. Paul goes over here, if God is for us, who can be against us? Okay? Over and over and over. That's the love. That's the covenanting, loving God. With us, for us. And also in the book of Revelation. I heard a great voice from the throne saying, behold, the swelling of God is with them. He will deal with them. They shall be his people. And God himself will be with them.
Swelling. I couldn't even figure out what it was supposed to be.
Now, just a little quote here from Brueggemann on it's a strange name for a baby. Wonderful thing. Such faithfulness is a scandal, the faithfulness of that God is for us. It violates all our religious conventions, for we prefer a God not so intensely set on us. The scandal is that it seems not to be so, and we do not wish it so, because it destroys the way we would arrange life. It need hardly be said that this good news calls our whole way of existence into question. It questions our reading of public life. Yoderisms, okay? Got that? It questions our reading of public life, for we would like to organize it in ways which violate his passion and his compassion. It also questions our self-perception. If we are indeed in his image, then the central task of our life is covenant making and covenant keeping with other human beings. In other words, being a lover to people. That's the point. It is a promise, both rich and heavy for us to say, that finally we shall be like him. Thus, our central human vocation, our central human job, is to be with brothers and sisters and for brothers and sisters. Okay? Who is God? That God is with and for. Who are we? To be with and for others. That is who he is. That is who we are called to be, expected to be, and promised to be. It is a strange name for a baby, Emmanuel. It is even a stranger name for God. God with us. The odd God.
Mm-hmm.
And the oddness of God makes you and I odd too. Okay? Okay. With and for. The center of the perspective of the Bible. The odd God. If chapter 4 does nothing else, I hope it will help you say that the grace and the love of God you've heard so much about in the New Testament is just as powerfully there in the Old. I hope that this chapter 4 can at least do that much for us. If not a whole lot more. I want to keep moving through here, and then shall I just go right on ahead?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Chapter 5. More of the same, comma, still to come. More of the same, still to come. Who are futurologists? That's my own word. Futurists is what normally, huh? They look at oil reserves, and they look at population.
Yeah.
Land, food, oil, energy, and say this is what's going to happen in the year 20.
Club of Rome.
Or Toffler, future shock, what it's going to do to us.
Yeah.
And futurism.
Futurism, futurologists and the like may help us some, Brueggemann says, but the best way to figure out what will happen in the future is to remember what happened in the past. The memories of the Bible are future oriented. And this is, for me, the most interesting statement out of the whole book. Every book's got to have one rememberable phrase for me. And this one is it. God's more interested in the promises yet to keep than the ones already kept.
Wow.
Isn't that fun?
Mm.
I mean, I spent all my time trying to remember what were the promises that God kept.
In other words, is that you're making promises?
No, actually, that's the whole point of the chapter. There's more to come. And Brueggemann, it's a brazen statement, I mean, in a way. He says, you know, God's more interested in the future than in the past. Even though most of our concentration, my concentration, is on the past always instead of on the future.
Hmm.
Does that strike you funny, too? I mean, is it an interesting quote?
Mm-hmm. It is, because in a sense we concentrate on teaching people what God has done in the past without emphasizing that God is going to continue to do that
very same thing in the
future. And we ought to be looking for it.
Yes. That's Brueggemann's point in this chapter. That's all he's going to say.
Mm-hmm.
But then he says, okay, now the important thing to say is, okay, then what exactly did God do in the past? And if we're going to know what God's going to do in the future, we better be clear about for the thousands of years that the faith was forming, what did the people see God doing? Because if we start looking for things that aren't going to actually happen, or that have no precedent, we're going to stand around the street corner a long time looking for something that isn't going to come down the road.
Mm-hmm. Can't God do anything new?
Sure. But the claim here is that that he's got certain inclinations. Sure. Behold, I am doing a new thing. There's new stuff.
But he follows it.
I was reading a book a few years ago, and it mentioned in this book that there is a compilation somewhere, I'm not sure, I don't remember the title or who did it, but of the promises of God as written down in the Bible. And there are like 1,000 or 2,000 instances where God makes promises to his people.
I don't know if he, I didn't get a chance to read chapter 5, so I don't know if he talks about that type of a thing. Or
no. What he's saying is that if we look to the history of Israel and to the history of the church, you figure out what God likes. What God,
follow like a certain pattern.
Yeah. You get a feel for repeated themes. And if we look to the future, that's, if we're going to lay your money on something, you just well lay your money on what's come up often in the past. He sees three themes.
Hmm.
Not a thousand, but three very distinct ones. There is more and more to come, but it will be more of the same. That may sound boring. Maybe it is. God will do in the future what God has done in the past. Three major shapes of the things to come. God is freedom giver. Exodus is the big Old Testament event. That's the formative event, he says, for Judaism. And for the New Testament, too. This great history begins in a brickyard in Egypt. But God answers. History is transformed. I won't read that. Exodus 3. Freedom is given precisely where it seems impossible. That's what the Bible is about. The young children of Israel had one cardinal truth that they had to recite at their bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs and their confirmation services. And that was, we were slaves and now we are free. They may be real slow, dullard kids, but that much they had to know. We were slaves, but now we are free. Exodus is the prism, the glasses, through which other experiences are seen. Going through Sinai, it's just another Exodus. Entering into Cana, it's just like Exodus. Flight from exile in the year 600, it's just like Exodus. Everything is played off an Exodus theme. Exodus is also about the great liberation movements of our time, not just theirs. We are called to be practitioners of liberation in our time. When we do that, we are doing more of the same. The Exodus, if you want to look to the future to see where God is working, the question is, where is Exodus taking place? Where is liberation happening? And Brueggemann is not a South American jungle bishop, you know, writing revolutionary literature. He's a, you know, he's a relatively boring Old Testament professor in Missouri. I mean, he's not boring. I mean, he's, but that's what he does. He sits in libraries and he reads old manuscripts. And what does he say? Liberation theology is exactly in the heart of the Old Testament. I mean, that's refreshing to me. It's something for somebody in South America to write that. But it's something else again for Walt Brueggemann to write that.
Just goes to show nobody's useless. God can talk to anybody.
Yeah. Okay, that's one thing. If you want to know what's going on in the future, look to the past. Liberation. Another thing. God is exile ender and home bringer.
Is it what?
Exile.
Oh, ender.
Exile ender and home bringer. The exile in Babylon happened about 598 and happened twice. 598, 587, 600 years before Jesus, the folks were in captivity. They were homeless, they were alienated, they were displaced. The pathos of the exile is alive and well today. Who are the homeless? They are the refugees, the war orphans, the urban renewal, people who have been displaced by urban renewal, those who don't belong, right? Keep making the list, okay? Who are the homeless? What the Bible says that God wants is to bring his people home. Shepherds bring home the lost, that warriors defeat Babylon so that the people can be set free. God is tender and powerful. Lots of quotations. Some, I mean, that sort of a tension is there all the time. Tender and powerful. It is to be at home. The invitation is to be at home in history, not home in heaven. Now, he is not saying that there is no such thing as a biblical doctrine of heaven. But the idea that by and by we will get home when we're dead is not a biblical theme. To be at home is to be in shalom now, on our real estate, with food on our tables. Okay? It's not in the by and by, though that is in the, that is a biblical thing. But it's a very present orientation to home. At-homeness is a great public, at-homeness in great public political events and in private personal ones as well. In other words, the liberation of the people of South Africa is a great public coming home. You and I have private homecomings we need too. We're alienated from ourselves, from our families, from each other. I mean, that's important also. That's being out of home, away from home. Feel of both things?
Mm-hmm.
It's public and it's private. When we help people come home, we are doing more of the same. We are all of us, this is a quote from Bergman, we are all of us seeking a homeland like Father Abraham in Hebrews 11. We do not doubt that God will keep his promise to create a new history of justice, freedom, and righteousness. What to look for in the future? One thing to look for is liberation. The other is come home, taking home country roads. Okay, that's one of the three biggie themes in the scriptures, as Bruton says. And third, that God is life bringer. In the Old Testament, the creation story is not a magic show. Okay, I think I'll do a duck on Thursday. Okay, that's not the point of it. It's not showing off. The point of it is a statement about a God who brings life from nothing, who brings order out of chaos, life out of death.
I read in Time or Newsweek that a group of creationists had gotten together and tried to make an experimental condition to prove that Noah's Ark had the flood that Noah's flood had caused all the fossil, and that they were caused by the animals who didn't run to the ark in time, and they're doing experiments to prove this. It just seems so absurd to me.
It really is absurd, isn't it?
It is making the headlines every day.
Every day.
Creationists and, the,
yes.
and what can be taught in school. Loss
so
it's getting
big.
A lot of
the fossils, I mean those that are in places where they normally should not be.
You know, any fossils were caused by the animals that didn't make it.
Or
I think,
well, some of the, yeah, okay.
In the latest issue of Christian Century, a person was writing about what lawsuits, what church-state lawsuits will we be seeing in the 1980s. And one of them that this gentleman pointed out was that in the next 10 years, we will see more and more lawsuits on the relationship of church and state regarding the teaching of scientific creationism.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but it's in the news now. It's going to stay in the news for a long time. People trying to get into public schools and etc. That sort of thing, which is an interesting diversion.
Yeah. And pastors getting sued for malpractice.
Yeah. The state suing pastors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're starting to take out.
Yes.
Well, the state and also.
Individual people have said because of counseling this or this happened, so they sued the pastor.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, take it out of insurance now.
Mm-hmm. That just seems wicked and pernicious to me.
The point of the creation story, Brueggemann says, is life, that God's the life bringer. In the New Testament, the crucifixion and the resurrection are life over death. The actions of Jesus are the same thing, for example, with Zacchaeus in Luke 19. Jesus manages to invert definitions so that what the world has thought was the way of death is in fact the celebrative gift of life. And what the world calls life, he showed to be deathly existence.
You turn it upside down.
Right. If you will save your life, you're going to lose it, but if you lose your life, you're going to save it. That reversal. The church has seen that Jesus does all three of these things above here, as they were done in the Old Testament. The church has also seen that these things are not just for Jesus, but for us. We are doing more of the same, in quotes, when we do them. We are confident that this is happening not because we can see the results, but because, to go back to chapter 4,
God is faithful as the covenant. Okay? What to look for in the future, he says. Look for the future, what has happened in the past. Freedom, liberation is the first. The second is that we can come home. And the third is that there will, is that we bring life where there is death. That's what to look for in the future. I like it when I can read a book every now and then. It just sort of takes all 1,700 pages of the Bible or however many, and just sort of says, the Lord, you can argue with the themes, but it's fun to say for someone to say, that's what I think are the three biggies.
Mm-hmm.
Liberation, coming home, and life out of death. Good way to evaluate our own life, or a good way to evaluate the village, or a good way to evaluate a parish. To say, what are we doing? To what degree are we living out the future? You know, to what degree are we acting? Are we helping liberation happen? To what degree are we helping people come home and life on and death?
In response to Paul's comment a little bit ago,
mm-hmm.
If you think that the only way that theology is future-oriented is for those groups who talk about the last things, the rapture, and all of that, there is another future-oriented theology. Moltmann, Pannenberg, realized eschatology is the fancy way to say it, that the present is shaped by the future. It isn't as though you sit and wait for Jesus to return and just are out of it here. I mean, that's been part of Christianity too. Mm-hmm. Samuel Miller or somebody convinced people to be up in their nightshirts on a hill in Pennsylvania because it was going to end on such and such an hour. You know, those people keep coming, for whom the God of the future means that it's pie in the sky by and by, and so they're not interested in justice. There are others whose present is shaped by the future. I think that's more biblical, or at least I think that would be consistent with Yoder. But those guys have not written easy books yet. I mean, they're heavy.
No, they haven't.
They're German heavies.
Yeah.
But you're right. We spend too much time on the past instead of that informing our hopefulness, our expectations.
Well, you know, it says something to me. This is a little off, but when you just said that about these German heavies, it really says something about what our, you know, all these people have good things to say, but they don't say it in a way that anybody without a master's degree can understand, and that's really not helpful.
It's not fair.
Mm-hmm.
And it leaves us, you know what it leaves us with? Jerry Falwell.
Mm-hmm.
Or Will Rogers and Dale Evans, uh-huh. For Sale at the Safeway store.
And so they have a big responsibility, I think, in, if you're going to think these things, fine, but, you know, come on, give us a break. Say it in a way that the rest of us can understand it.
Another way to put that, though, is what they're doing is they have the luxury and the time and the scholarship to be putting down what some ordinary folk lived out.
Mm-hmm.
The theologians can help you live the Christian faith, or you can live the Christian faith and know that someday somebody will write a doctoral dissertation
on what this world did
to cope with the present struggle for justice. That's mm-hmm. right. And liturgically and with our own conversation, we shouldn't wait for those people to tell us what to do. They should, 10 years from now, clarify what we did. That's right.
Well, yes and no, but I mean, I think there could be a little more interplay between the two, because I feel like it's, you know, that we can say, well, no creed but Christ, we just read the Bible. But, you know, people come to it with so much stuff, mm-hmm. and theologians who have the time and the luxury to sit down and do nothing but study the Bible all day could make it a little easier for us to take advantage of what they have to say. It seems like a real huge split. It's a real crummy thing to do to the laity. I mean, why do they have to do that?
I think it's just our own human limitations that put us that way.
and it kind of, it keeps us working together as a community, because now something like these parable things that Jim has been reading and barely understands, he's been able to teach us. And maybe somewhere down the line, Jim is going to translate these immense understandings into lay people's language. And then lay people are going to understand it. I think it takes an immensely intelligent person to be able to think on the level of $40 words and speak to people that only understand $2 words.
But that's asking too much.
I think, well, I have immense respect for those people because I think there are very few people that do that. Once you get yourself into this truly intellectual word frame, you know, like when I listen to John talk, a lot of times he just flies out with words that are just way beyond me because I haven't got up to that. But it seems in order to get to those words, get to where words like exegesis and hermeneutics are just, you know, that's an everyday thing, you have to forsake the practice of the simpler language that people use. And so if you've got somebody that can encompass the whole range, that's really super.
I think that Holly's invitation to a publishing house would be well met to say, take the $40 word people, you know, take the Wolfhard Pannenbergs and all these heavyweights, and find some other people who can read them, just barely, mm-hmm. and translate, please. Uh-huh.